hot. Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 940. The Troop and Contrabanda, part 14. Unsettling in part 2. German Ostpolitik, part 5. This is being recorded on December 28th of the year 2016. The information that I'm going to be highlighting in this program is heavily overlapped with what we talked about in, For the Record, 939. Information about the nature of the allegations that Russia is behind the profile hacks, the hack of the DNC, the hack of Clinton campaign chairman John P. Podesta's Gmail account, and also the shadow broker's hack, or really non-hack as it appears to have been, have all been hung around the neck of Putin. Basically, Russia is being blamed for this, despite the fact that the information points away from Russia. A WikiLeaks associate and a former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan named Craig Murray has alleged that he was given the information about the DNC from an insider. Whether or not that is accurate and whether or not that was, in fact, coupled with a hacking attempt on the DNC, there are substantive points of information arguing against Russia being the source of the DNC hack, the shadow broker's non-hack, or the hack on John Podesta's Gmail account. I will reprint in this, in the description to the program, information about how the hack itself does not fit the profile of past Russian hacking activities and why, in fact, the operational security of the DNC hack, or OPSEC as it is called, is altogether uncharacteristic of what we have seen vis-a-vis official Russian state cyber activities. Beyond that, the information suggests that the shadow broker's non-hack of the NSA was not a hack at all, but a leak by an insider, as Craig Murray is alleging, took place with the DNC hack itself. What we're going to be looking at in this program is, first of all, a curious detail about the hack of John Podesta's Gmail account. Again, he's Clinton's campaign chairman, and we're going to take a look at how there was an attempt at using his password that was reported as coming out of Ukraine. Now, that Bitly account, it has been linked in American officialdom to the fancy bear, unquote, group of Russian hackers. What we're going to look at in this program is how Ukrainian hackers associated with the OUNB heirs currently in power in Ukraine, courtesy of the Maidan coup, have not only drawn up a list of journalists who are listed as Russian sympathizers or active agents or dupes, how in turn that list has been linked with Ukrainian intelligence and with the Ukrainian fascist parties and the officials of Ukrainian fascist parties who are in power in Ukraine. Recently, the Washington Post published an article talking about Russian dupes/agents of influence/collaborators in the American media and on online American outlets, various websites and blogs that were alleged by the Prop or Not group to be Russian disinformation vehicles, willingly or through ignorance and consequent manipulation. We're going to be going into, once again, an article by Mark Ains, who's doing some of the best investigative reporting in the world, in my opinion. And what Mark Ains has done is to point out that some tweets from the Prop or Not group suggests that they have some significant links to the Ukrainian fascists and OUNB heirs who came to power as a result of the Maidan coup. Recall that the death of the Clinton-Obama administration reboot with Russia was effected by Eddie the Friendly Spook's activities. And Eddie Snowden, despite the fact that the information argues otherwise, endorsed the view that Russia was behind the DNC hack and that Russia was behind the shadow brokers hack. This comes close to the concept, the legal concept of consciousness of guilt. If you can be proved to have lied in order to cover up the commission of a crime, that is considered prima facie evidence for indicting you for the commission of the crime you lied about to protect. And that applies in this case to a large extent anyway to Eddie Snowden's pronouncements about the DNC hack and the shadow brokers hack. In both cases, he would certainly have known that one should be much more circumspect about such things and that the evidence actually argued against Russia being behind either or both events. And yet, Snowden, who one would expect to know, argued that Russia was, in all probability, behind them. Recall that the Maidan coup was financed in part by Pierre Omidyar, at whose First Look Media, Glenn Greenwald, Eddie Snowden's leaking journalist of choice, and himself a Nazi fellow traveler, holds forth. And again, we've spoken about this in connection with the Conga Line Ops and many of the aspects that I have analyzed in The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook. Now, in the excerpt that I'm going to read from the Mark Ains article, we're going to point out that, first of all, the Prop or Not group, the anonymous group quoted by the Washington Post as designating various media outlets, blogs, and websites as Russian collaborators, that Prop or Not group appears to be linked to the Ukrainian fascists that came to power through the Maidan coup. Beyond that, the Ukrainian fascist government has put together a website, a link, or a website listing a bunch of journalists who were deemed to be collaborators with Russia. That website was put together by Ukrainian intelligence officials operating, and this is very important, operating with Ukrainian hackers who were sympathetic to the Maidan / OUNB successor government in power in Kiev. We looked at that in a recent program, for the record, 206 and also in 216. It is interesting that Andrew Higgins, among others, a relatively conservative journalist for the New York Times, found his name on that particular list. We should also note that one of the key sources in attempting to pin the DNC hack on Russia and also alleging Russian hacking of the elections and the election machines themselves is a Ukrainian-American activist named Alexandra Chalupa, C-H-A-L-U-P-A. She is a major source for the Clinton campaign on DNC's Russia Bibit, and she also appears to be linked with the OUNB successor government in Ukraine. And again, that OUNB successor government in Ukraine, put together in combination with its intelligence services and hackers working with the Ukrainian intelligence services, a list of journalists who were Russian dupes or collaborators. So we're looking at two compilations of Russian, alleged Russian dupes and collaborators in the media, one by prop or not, and the other by the very possibly linked OUNB successor government in Ukraine, where a list of journalists was put together by its intelligence services. And again, one cannot stress this strongly enough, a group of hackers working with the Ukrainian fascist government. All of which goes a long way toward showing the Galen OUNB ABN roots of some of the debate that has been encompassing this country's political landscape, in which we see the very odd situation of mainstream conservative Republicans sounding the alarm about Russian interference in American elections, and yet we see Donald Trump and his National Security Advisor designate Michael Flynn poo-pooing that notion as being dissatisfied, coming from dissatisfied CIA elements. What we're really looking at, in my opinion, is a struggle between an American deep state, that embodied in the right-wing Republicans, and the CIA-linked elements and OUNB and ABN-linked elements that are basically pointing the accusing finger at Russia, and a Trump administration that I believe is not only the underground right transformed into an above-ground mass movement, but one that is implementing long-standing elements of German geopolitics, the diminution of NATO, its eventual replacement with a German-dominated all-EU army, the ending of sanctions against Russia, which German big business wants to do, and ultimately I expect a formal or informal trade union stretching all the way from Lisbon on the Atlantic Ocean to Vladivostok on the Pacific, and incorporating Russia. I think we will see some concessions by Vladimir Putin, and generally I think the Atlanticist alliance that has dominated the Cold War and which elements of the American deep state are attempting to perpetuate, I think those elements, by the way, in many ways in thrall to the underground Reich, which is doing a good cop, bad cop thing, in my opinion. On the one hand, the bad cop, the Democratic Party with Alexander Chalupa, and elements of the traditional Republican right are bashing Russia and Putin and saying we've got to do something about this. At the same time, a Europe which is manifesting various forms of fascist political activity, at its root linked with Germany and the underground Reich, are moving toward a German-dominated Europe, both economically and militarily separated from the U.S., the German Ostpolitik that I had spoken about in For the Record 918, and 919, I think, is being made manifest. And the underground Reich playing good cop with the Trump administration and European political interests allied with it, and also playing bad cop with people like Alexander Chalupa and the OUNB fascists in Ukraine, going, look how terrible Russia is, at the same time as Donald Trump is tweeting about a huge American nuclear weapons buildup, something which, in my opinion, will accelerate Europe's move away from the U.S. This whole process, I think, is as fascinating as it is convoluted and as it is consummately important. We are literally, in my opinion, witnessing the end of an epic. I know this is complicated. We're going to be getting into other aspects of how the Trump administration is implementing German Ostpolitik. We're going to take a look at Austria and the Freedom Party there. We're going to take a look at François Fillon in France, who at the same time favors a German-led European military buildup for an EU army. At the same time, he favors a rapprochement with Russia. The Freedom Party in Austria, founded by German Nazis, has a similar stance, and it has been networking with Michael Flynn, the alt-right sympathetic general, who is Donald Trump's national security advisor designate. So, German Ostpolitik, the creation of an all-EU army, the lifting of sanctions against Russia, which German corporations want to do, and ultimately, I think, a resolution between the EU and Germany and Russia about Ukraine, resulting in a trade union encompassing all of Europe, dominated by Germany, and incorporating Russia and Eurasia. Those are the dynamics I see rising through this. This is complicated, so hang on.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, beginning with the subject of the hack into John D. Podesta's email account, or John Podesta's email account. John Podesta being the Clinton campaign chairman. From CBS News of October 28th of 2016, the phishing email that hacked the account of John Podesta. This appears to be the phishing email that hacked Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta's Gmail account. Further, the Clinton campaign's own computer help desk thought it was real email sent by Google, even though the email address had a suspicious googlemail.com extension. The email with the subject line, "Someone has your password," greeted Podesta, "Hi, John," and then said, "Someone just used your password to try to sign into your Google account, john.podesta@gmail.com. Then it offered a timestamp and an IP address in location Ukraine, unquote. Skipping down. "Google stopped this sign-in attempt. You should change your password immediately." And then it offered a link to change his password. This is a legitimate email. Charles Bellavan at the HFA help desk wrote to Podesta's chief of staff, Sarah Latham, "John needs to change his password immediately and ensure that two-factor authentication is turned on his account." Bellavan included the Gmail link that would be used to change a user's password, but whoever changed Podesta's password instead clicked on the shortened URL that was in the original phishing email. This is the same technique used to hack Colin Powell's emails and the Democratic National Committee emails, according to the website Motherboard. And then it goes on to try to link this to Russia. So, again, note that apparently there was an attempt to hack into John Podesta's email account. It listed location Ukraine. Then someone used the phishing email to reestablish the password, or to change the password to John Podesta's account, and that permitted the hack, at least that this information can be trusted. Who exactly did that? I don't know. Might it have been an insider that allegedly gave information about the DNC emails to Craig Murray? Might Craig Murray or that insider, perhaps Tulsi Gabbard or someone else, have been involved with giving away key information that permitted the hack? Might Alexandra Chalupa have been involved with the hack? These are all questions that I think need to be answered, but I think they are questions that cast the greatest of doubt on the Russia did it meme that is dominating American media coverage of this. Now, Mark Ames, alternet.org, article from December 7th of 2016. The anonymous blacklist quoted by the Washington Post has apparent ties to Ukrainian fascism and CIA spying. This by Mark Ames, again from alternet.org from December 7th of 2016. Now, again, there's the Prop or Not group that was cited by the Washington Post as the generators of the blacklist of Russian complicit journalists and or blogs and or websites. Then there is the Ukrainian Hacker and Intelligence Service compiled list of journalists who are collaborators of Russian intelligence and propaganda. What links exist between these two compilations? Obviously, that is something to be contemplated, and that is why Mark Ames is bringing it up. And then note that one of the main sources for the Democratic National Committee's charges that Russia did the hack is a Ukrainian-American activist named Alexandra Chalupa, who apparently is a major generator of the meme that Russia did the hacks. And she certainly appears to be linked to the American lobbying milieu that is allied with the OUNB heirs advocate, who came to power as a result of the Maidan coup. From Mark Ames' article, skipping down. First, about Prop or Not and their links to Ukrainian fascism. Still the question lingers, who is behind Prop or Not? Who are they? We may have to await the defamation lawsuits that are almost certainly coming from those smeared by the Post and by Prop or Not. Their description sounds like the About tab on any number of Washington front groups that journalists and researchers are used to coming across. Quote, Prop or Not is an independent team of concerned American citizens with a wide range of backgrounds and expertise, including professional experience in computer science, statistics, public policy, and national security affairs. The only specific clues given were an admission that at least one of its members with access to its Twitter handle is Ukrainian American. They had given this away in a handful of early Ukrainian language tweets parroting Ukrainian ultranationalist slogans before the group became widely known. One Prop or Not tweet dated November 17th invokes a 1940s Ukrainian fascist salute, Heroyam Slava, to cheer a news item on Ukrainian hackers fighting Russians. The phrase means glory to the heroes, and it was formally introduced by the Fascist Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUN, at their March and April 1941 Congress in Nazi-occupied Krakow, as they prepared to serve as Nazi auxiliaries in Operation Barbarossa, the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in World War II. And then quoting from Gregor Rosominski-Liba's biography of Stefan Bandera, the leader of the OUN. The OUNB introduced another Ukrainian fascist salute at the Second Great Congress of the Ukrainian Nationalists in Krakow in March and April of 1941. This was the most popular Ukrainian fascist salute and had to be performed according to the instructions of the OUNB leadership by raising the right arm, quote, slightly to the right, slightly above the peak of the head, unquote, while calling glory to Ukraine, unquote, and responding glory to the heroes, or as the Prop or Not group tweeted, here I am, Slava, unquote. 2 months after formalizing this salute Nazi forces allowed Bandera's Ukrainian fascists to briefly take control of Lviv, at the time a predominantly Jewish and Polish city, whereupon the Ukrainian patriots murdered, tortured, and raped thousands of Jews in one of the most barbaric and bloodiest pogroms ever. By the way, that was performed by the Noctigal Battalion, or Nightingale Battalion, headed up by Roman Shukhevich, the head of the UPA. His son, Yuri Shukhevich, then carried on the fight against the former Soviet Union, and the UPA eventually formed a political front that became Pravi Sektor, a major element of the current Ukrainian government. And we've spoken about Pravi Sektor at great length in the past. Note that Roman Shukhevich was named the Hero of the Ukraine, as has been Stefan Bandera. And more about the honoraria that have been conferred upon them. Since the 2014 revolution brought Ukrainian neo-fascists back into the highest rungs of power, Ukraine's Nazi collaborators and wartime fascists have been rehabilitated as heroes with major highways and roads named after them and public commemorations honoring them. The Speaker of Ukraine's Parliament, Andrei Perebyi, founded Ukraine's neo-Nazi Social National Party of Ukraine and published a white supremacist manifesto, View from the Right, featuring the Parliament Speaker in full neo-Nazi uniform in front of fascist flags with the Nazi Reichsangel symbol. Ukraine's powerful Interior Minister Arsen Avakov sponsors several ultra-nationalist and neo-Nazi militia groups like the Azov Battalion, and last month he helped appoint another neo-Nazi, Vadim Troyan, as head of Ukraine's National Police. By the way, Vadim Troyan had been a high-ranking member of the Azov Battalion. Earlier this year, when Troyan was still the police chief of the capital of Kiev, he was widely accused of having ordered an illegal surveillance operation on investigative journalist Pavel Sheremet, Sheremet, just before Sheremet was assassinated by a car bomb. Since coming to power in the 2014 Maidan Revolution, Ukraine's U.S.-backed regime has waged an increasingly surreal war on journalists who don't toe the Ukrainian ultranationalist line and against treacherous Kremlin propagandists, real and imagined. 2 years ago, Ukraine established a Ministry of Truth. This year, the war has gone from surreal paranoia to an increasingly deadly kind of terror. And obviously, what Ames is talking about here is correlating the Prop or Not list that was published by the Washington Post with a list of Russian dupe-slash-collaborating journalists that was put together by the Ukrainian government, its intelligence services, and skilled hackers allied with the OUNB heirs in power in Ukraine.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
One of the more, continuing with Ames' article, one of the more frightening policies enacted by the current oligarch nationalist regime in Kiev is an online blacklist of journalists accused of collaborating with pro-Russian terrorists. The website Mirotvorets, or Peacemaker, was set up by Ukrainian hackers working with state intelligence and police, all of which tend to share the same ultra-nationalist ideologies as Parabli and the newly appointed neo-Nazi chief of the National Police. Condemned by the Committee to Protect Journalists and numerous news organizations in the West and in Ukraine, The online blacklist includes the names and personal private information on some 4,500 journalists, including several Western journalists and Ukrainians working for Western media. The website is designed to frighten and muzzle journalists from reporting anything but the pro-nationalist party line, and it has the backing of government officials, spies, and police, including the SBU, Ukraine's successor to the KGB, the powerful Interior Minister Avakov, and his notorious far-right deputy Anton Gerashenko. Ukraine's journalist blacklist website, operated by Ukrainian hackers working with state intelligence, led to a rash of death threats against the doxxed journalists whose email addresses, phone numbers, and other private information was posted anonymously to the website. This again, Ukrainian's journalist blacklist website, operated by Ukrainian hackers working with state intelligence, led to a rash of death threats against the doxxed journalists whose email addresses, phone numbers, and other private information was posted anonymously to the website. Parenthetically, the DNC hack information put up on WikiLeaks' website also had email addresses, private addresses, and phone numbers of DNC members on it. Continuing with Ames' account, many of these threats against the journalists came with the wartime Ukrainian fascist salute, Slava Ukraini, glory to Ukraine. So when prop or not, anonymous, quote, researchers, unquote, reveal only their Ukrainian identity, it is hard not to think about the spy-linked hackers who posted the deadly Mirot Voretz blacklist of treasonous, unquote, journalists. Because the prop or not blacklist of American journalist traitors is anonymous, and the Washington Post front page article protects their anonymity, we can only speculate on their identity with what little information they have given us. And that little bit of information reveals only a Ukrainian ultra-nationalist thread. The salute, the same obsessively violent paranoia towards Russia and towards journalists who, in the eyes of Ukrainian nationalists, have always been dupes and stooges, if not outright collaborators of Russian evil. One of the key media sources who blamed the DNC hacks on Russia, ramping up fears of crypto-Putinist infiltration, is a Ukrainian-American lobbyist working for the DNC. She is Alexandra, A-L-E-X-A-N-D-R-A, Chalupa, C-H-A-L-U-P-A, described as head of the Democratic National Committee's opposition research on Russia and on Trump, and founder and president of the Ukrainian lobby group U.S. United with Ukraine Coalition, which lobbied hard to pass a 2014 bill increasing loans and military aid to Ukraine, imposing sanctions on Russians, and tightly aligning U.S. and Ukraine geostrategic interests. In October of this year, Yahoo News named Chalupa one of, quote, 16 people who shaped the 2016 election for her role in pinning the DNC leaks on Russian hackers and for making the case that the Trump campaign was under Kremlin control. And skipping down, Chalupa worked with veteran reporter Michael Isikoff of Yahoo News to publicize her opposition research on Trump, Russia, and Paul Manafort, as well as her many Ukrainian sources. In one leaked DNC email earlier this year, Chalupa boasted to DNC Communications Director Luis Miranda that she brought Isikoff to a U.S. government-sponsored Washington event featuring 68 Ukrainian journalists, where Chalupa was invited, quote, to speak specifically about Paul Manafort, unquote. In turn, Isikoff names her as the key inside source, quote, proving, unquote, that the Russians were behind the hacks and that Trump's campaign was under the spell of Kremlin spies and sorcerers. Again, Alexander Chalupa being cited by Isikoff, who used to write for Newsweek, as the key inside source, quote, proving, unquote, that the Russians were behind the hacks. And again, that source linked with the OUNB fascists in power in Ukraine, who A, grew up in combination with their intelligence services and skilled hackers, a group of journalists who were alleged Russian dupes, and this at the same time as the Washington Post quotes the Prop or Not group about a group of journalists, media outlets, and blogs and websites that were Kremlin dupes, unquote. So again, the role of Ukrainian hackers in this, and in this regard, serving as something of a provocation, something certainly heating up the new Cold War, and also, by the way, moving Hillary Clinton and the Democrats in a more hawkish political direction, one that certainly did not help them with the left wing of the Democratic Party during the campaign. And wrapping up Mark Ames' commentary here, skipping down. To be clear, I am not arguing that Alexander Chalupa is behind Prop or Not, but it is important to provide context to the boasts by Prop or Not about its Ukrainian nationalist links within the larger context of the Clinton campaign's anti-Kremlin hysteria, which crossed the line into Cold War xenophobia time and time again. An anti-Russian xenophobia shared by Clinton's Ukrainian nationalist allies. Indeed. That Trump continues to surround himself by people who are sympathetic to one iteration or another of fascism, now being euphemized as, quote, alt-right, unquote. Reviewing another article that we looked at in our last program, Mother Jones, from December 14th of 2016, an article by Josh Harkinson, H-A-R-K-I-N-S-O-N, Trump's newest senior advisor seen as a white nationalist ally. Skipping down. President-elect Donald Trump's newest pick to be a senior advisor in the White House has long ties to a prominent white nationalist who sees him as an ally of the movement. Stephen Miller, a top aide to Trump's presidential campaign, will serve as a senior White House advisor for policy. Trump's transition team announced Tuesday. Miller is a former staffer for the nativist Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican of Alabama, now Trump's nominee for attorney general. The announcement of Miller's new role drew praise from white nationalist leader Richard Spencer. Quote, Stephen is a highly competent and tough individual. Spencer, who famously coined the term alt-right to describe the insurgent right-wing movement that has attracted white nationalists and supremacists, told Mother Jones on Wednesday, so I have no doubt that he will do a great job. As we looked at in, for the record, 937 and in 938, General Michael Flynn, who is going to be Donald Trump's new national security advisor, has similar alt-right political inclinations. And now he has been networking, apparently, with the Freedom Party in Austria, headed up for a long time by Jörg Haider. Another article that we touched on very briefly in, for the record, 939, this from Bloomberg Politics of December 19th of 2016 by Boris Greendahl, or Greendahl, G-R-O-E-N-D-A-H-L, and Jonathan Cironi, T-I-R-O-N-E. Austrian populists go to Moscow to pitch Trump-Putin bridge. And skipping down, Austria's populist Freedom Party said it wants to broker an end to sanctions on Russia by using its contacts with the White House and the Kremlin to reduce East West pensions. Freedom Party leader Heinz Christian Strache, S-T-R-I-C-H-E, and Norbert Hofer, H-O-F-E-R, the losing candidate in this month's presidential election, signed a working agreement, unquote, with Russian President Vladimir Putin's United Russia Party in Moscow on Monday, according to a statement issued by the Austrian party. It added that Strache met last month in New York with Michael Flynn, nominated to become President-elect Donald Trump's national security advisor. Beginning at that last sentence again. It added that Strache met last month in New York with Michael Flynn, nominated to become President-elect Donald Trump's national security advisor. Strache wants to roll back the sanctions that are harmful and ultimately useless for the economy, unquote, according to the Freedom Party statement, which described itself as, quote, a neutral and reliable mediator and partner, unquote. The delegation met with United Russia's International Secretary, Sergei Zelezniak, Z-H-E-L-E-Z-N-Y-A-K, according to a spokesman for the Russian party. This is the first formal agreement with a major party from EU member state since the bloc imposed its sanctions on Russia for annexing Crimea and supporting separatists in eastern Ukraine. Again, the Freedom Party serving as a bridge between Putin and Trump and working to get these sanctions against Russia lifted. That is one of the goals of corporate Germany that is, as we have seen, under the control of the remarkable and deadly Bormann Capital Network itself, grown out of the cartel system that was set up between the two world wars. More about the origins of the Austrian Freedom Party from the New York Times of November 29th of 2016 by Alison Smale. Austria's far right sees a prize within reach, the presidency, skipping down. The Hofer here is Norbert Hofer, who actually narrowly lost the election for presidency to Mr. von der Bellen of the Austrian Green Party. With Trump's victory, the barrier against us has loosened a bit, Mr. Hofer said with evident satisfaction. The existence of such barriers hints at a lasting stigma around the Freedom Party, which was created by a group of former Nazis in the 1950s and gained political traction under the charismatic leadership of the populist Jörg Haider in the 1990s. Skipping down. A TV talk show host, Corina Milborn, M-I-L-B-O-R-N, grilled Mr. Hofer last week for an hour over his alleged nationalist views and his calls for undoing the unjust border, unquote, that keeps South Tyrol, a region of northern Italy, apart from Austria's Tyrol. Mr. Hofer's grin evaporated, and he almost blew his cool. And we're going to very briefly revisit a little bit about the heritage of the Freedom Party, again, serving as something of a bridge between the Trump, well, transition team and the Putin government in Russia to, among other things, lift the sanctions on Russia.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
From the Daily Mail of March 18th of 2009, an article by Billy Briggs, B, R as in Roger, I, G as in George, G as in George, S. The far right is on the march again. the rise of fascism in Austria. And this is about the Freedom Party and some of the Nazis who actually helped to generate it. One of those is an SS veteran of the Leibstandarte, Adolf Hitler. That is the 1st Waffen-SS Division. This is a guy named Herbert Schweiger. Skipping down. Herbert Schweiger, S-C-H-W-E-I-G-E-R, makes no attempt to hide his Nazi views. At his home in the Austrian mountains, the former SS officer gazes out a window to a view of a misty alpine valley. Described to me as the puppet master of the far right, Schweiger 85 is a legendary figure for neo-Nazis across the world. Our time is coming again, and soon we will have another leader like Hitler, he says. Still remarkably sharp-minded, Schweiger was a lieutenant in the infamous Waffen-SS Panzer Division Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler, an elite unit originally formed before World War II to act as the Führer's personal bodyguards. And talking about Schweiger's career, he was a founding member of 3 political parties in Austria, the VDU, the banned NDP, and the Freedom Party. He has given his support to the current leader of the Freedom Party. Strache is doing the right thing by fighting the foreigner, says Schweiger. He is now in close contact with the Kameradschaft and underground cells of hardcore neo-Nazis across Austria and Germany, who over the past 3 years have started to infiltrate political parties such as the FPO or Freedom Party. His belief that the bullet and the ballot box go hand in hand goes back to 1961, when he helped to train a terrorist movement fighting for the reunification of Austria and South Tyrol. I was an explosives expert in the SS, so I trained Burschenschaften how to make bombs. We used the hotel my wife and I owned as a training camp, he says. The hotel he refers to is 50 yards from his home. 30 people in Italy were murdered during the campaign. One of the men convicted for the atrocities, Norbert Berger, later formed the now-banned neo-Nazi NDP party with Schweiger. Again, this Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler Waffen-SS explosives expert is one of the founders of the Freedom Party and also helped to train people in bomb-making for a terror campaign in support of South Tyrolean reunification with Austria, one of the causes that Mr. Hofer held near and dear. Another interesting thing, François Fillon, who is got the center right nomination to challenge to head France. This from Defense News of July 13th of 2016. Defense spending emerges as French election topic. This by Pierre Twain. François Fillon, a former prime minister, said July 13th he would commit France to spending 2% of its gross domestic product on defense and also retain the airborne and submarine-launched nuclear weapons if he won the presidential election next year. Skipping down. International tension would not allow France, quote, to lower its guard on the nuclear deterrent front, he said, adding that Russia is rearming, building nuclear subs, and installing anti-ballistic missile defense capabilities around Moscow. It was a major mistake for NATO to extend its reach so close to Russia, and it was important for Paris and Moscow to pursue a dialogue as Russia remains a European country, Fillon said, skipping down again. France should persuade Germany to set up a European army, according to Fillon. Berlin could not rely wholly on NATO, as the alliance was unable to meet the threat from the Islamic State, he argued. Again, this the French center-right candidate to become head of state there. He is in favor of a German-led all-EU army, and yet he favors rapprochement with Putin. From the New York Times of November 30th of 2016, an article by Max Fisher, M-A-X, last name F-I-S-H-E-R, French election hints at a European shift toward Russia. This reads in part, the victory of François Fillon, F-I-L-L-O-N, in France's center-right presidential primary is the latest sign that a tectonic shift is coming to the European order toward accommodating rather than countering a resurgent Russia. Since the end of World War II, European leaders have maintained their ever-growing alliance as a bulwark against Russian power. Through decades of ups and downs in Russian-European relations, in periods of estrangement or reconciliation, their balance of power has kept the continent stable. But a growing movement within Europe that includes Mr. Fillon, along with others of a more populist bent, is pushing a new policy. Instead of standing up to President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia, stand with him. Mr. Fillon has called for lifting sanctions on Russia and for partnering with Moscow in an effort to curtail immigration and terrorism. Skipping down. These changes, along with the impending British withdrawal from the European Union and the election of Donald J. Trump as president of the U.S., foretell a dramatic shift, unquote, in the half-century of Western unity against Russia, said James Goldgeier, G-O-L-D-G-E-I-E-R, a political scientist and the dean of American University's School of International Service in Washington. And skipping down again. Similar trends are playing out in several European countries along their own particular national lines. In Germany, for instance, center-left leaders are pushing to abandon their country's role in leading European efforts to counter Russia. Instead, they advocate reverting to the Cold War era policy of Ostpolitik, in which West Germany sought a neutral balancing role between East and West. Often West European politicians do not see themselves as explicitly calling for aligning with Moscow, but rather for abandoning the costly mission to counter Russia's aggression toward against faraway Eastern states at a moment when they have more immediate concerns. West European leaders see themselves as fighting an increasingly untenable two-front war, a southern front against immigration and terrorism, and an eastern front against Russia. The eastern front is largely a project of policy establishments that see it as essential to maintaining Europe's post-war order. Voters are more skeptical. A 2015 Pew poll found that slight majorities in France, Germany, and Italy said their countries should not uphold their treaty obligation to defend an Eastern NATO ally should it be attacked by Russia. Voters, particularly those on the right, have long seen southern issues, terrorism and immigration, as more important. Their threats to install far-right governments that would dismantle the European project entirely are increasingly credible. Well, that is interesting. And again, I've in For the Record 918 and 919, I spoke about or I detailed some of the history of German Ostpolitik in the post-World War II period. And by the late 40s and early 1950s, Germany was already introducing a German-led unified Europe as one policy goal, and also a German-led all-EU army as an accompanying policy, and moving out of NATO in response to American saber-rattling and the prospect of the U.S. leading Europe into a nuclear war with the former Soviet Union. Those were all contributing factors, and I think that those dynamics are in many ways playing out on the world scene today. Again, the Austrian Freedom Party now officially moving to serve as a bridge between Putin and the Trump administration. Its overt Nazi roots are something that we took a look at in connection with Herbert Schweiger, whose South Tyrolean nationalist policies were backed with armed force, deadly force. Those are the same policies now being espoused by Norbert Hofer and the Green Party. Herbert Schweiger being one of the Freedom Party, rather. Herbert Schweiger being one of the founders of that party. Trump's new Secretary of State designate is Rex W. Tillerson. That's T-I-L-L-E-R-S-O-N. He is the CEO for ExxonMobil. Now, ExxonMobil is the gigantic firm that sees the merger of Standard Oil of New Jersey, Exxon, with Standard Oil of New York, which is Mobil. Exxon used to be SO, ESSO, which was a corruption of S period O period, or Standard Oil. Mobil used to be Saucony Vacuum, Saucony being Standard Oil Company of New York. It was called Standard Vacuum Oil Company, then Standard Mobil, or Saucony Vacuum, then Saucony Mobil, and finally just Mobil. Now, Standard of New Jersey, Exxon, is merged with Standard of New York, Mobil, and Rex Tillerson is the head of that. New York Times, December 13th of 2016, article by Michael D. Shear. Trump lines up establishment Republicans to vouch for Tillerson. And many mainstream Republicans are backing Tillerson, but he is also being attacked because of his views on Russia. Skipping down. At the center of the debate are questions about Mr. Tillerson's vocal opposition to American sanctions imposed on Russia as he pursued oil and gas deals in that country. Again, working to lift sanctions against Russia, something that is a goal of corporate Germany and the entity that dominates corporate Germany, that is the Bormann Capital Network. Lifting the sanctions against Russia is also part of the agenda that is being advocated by the Freedom Party in Austria, now networking directly with Putin, according to its leader, and also with Michael Flynn, the national security advisor for Donald Trump. Now, the company that Tillerson, again, who favors lifting the sanctions, the company that he heads is Standard Oil of New Jersey and Standard Oil of New York, now merged. That places him with a company that has a tremendous amount of influence wielded within it by the Bormann Capital Network. We're going to wrap things up with this article, this excerpt, I should say, from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Of the Bormann Network, vastly diversified, it is said to be the largest landowner in South America and, through stock holdings, controls German heavy industry and the trust established by the late Hermann Schmidt, former president of IG Farben, who held as much stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey as did the Rockefellers. Again, one more time. Of the Bormann Group, it controls German heavy industry, which wants to lift sanctions against Russia, and the trust established by the late Hermann Schmitz, former president of IG Farben, who held as much stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey as did the Rockefellers. The pro-Russian stance of many of Europe's fascist parties also plays into a Yaquiite dynamic. We spoke about Francis Parker Yaqui in the past. Accessing the landmark work, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaqui and the Post-War Fascist International. Yaqui felt that the future of fascism basically lay with a German-dominated and unified Europe, including Russia, allied with much of the Third World and Asia against the U.S. and the Jews. So we'll see how this all plays out. This concludes For the Record program number 940, The Trip and Confabanda part 14, Unsettling in part 2, subtitled German Ostpolitik part 5, being recorded on December 28th of the year 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.